It was real early, and I went into the garage because that's where the ladder is to get into the attic. Because I heard some noise, and I thought it was something on our house. It was really early in the morning. And it wasn't something on the roof, and so I thought, it must be in the attic. And so I thought, I need to take care of this. So I pulled down the ladder, you know what I'm talking about, that little ladder that comes down from the attic. I pulled it down, and I walked up the steps, and it's a little dark in our attic. We have this one little light, but I took a flashlight with me, and I was trying to scope out what was going on. And I was shining this flashlight all through the attic, and all of a sudden it landed on two big, beady eyes. Turns out it was a raccoon. To me, it looked like it was about this big, but it's probably about this big. And I come to find out later that it was a female, and she was not happy. I mean, she was angry. She was hissing. She was moving at me. And so I didn't know what to do because I was not going to tackle a raccoon in my attic, worried about I was going to go right through the roof. And so I quietly backed away and went down the ladder and closed the ladder. And then I called a guy who was a critter control, and he specializes in raccoons, he tells me. And so he came out, and he said, oh, yeah, you've got a female up there, and she's pregnant, and she's not happy. And I go, okay, we need to take care of that. He said, actually, there have been a whole lot of raccoons up there, and it's a biohazard mess up there. And I'm going, really? You're kidding me? He said, yeah, all of that insulation's got to come out. We've got to reseal it and put all this new insulation. It costs about $20,000, church, to fix our attic, actually. Thank goodness for an insurance guy who's a good friend of mine. And so, and he told me that the only way to catch this female is to put a special trap out because all the guys had left. So I asked him, I said, why did the guys leave? And he goes, well, that's typical. You know, when the female gets pregnant, the guys scatter. And I'm going, okay. And so we caught this raccoon, crisis averted, apparently, except for the $20-some thousand it cost to fix the attic and all the insulation and all that. That was just one crisis that I've had in my life. And chances are you probably had a crisis in your life as well. Some might argue that we're in a crisis right now as a nation, as a world, as we deal with this pandemic that many of us are thinking about. And so I want to talk to you today about crisis as we continue on in our study of the book of Mark, the Overlooked Gospel. We've been studying that now for 12 weeks, and I'm glad you're here with us. Thank you for joining us. I want to welcome all of our campuses that are joining us right now. I want to thank you, those of you that are live right here in the Centerville campus. It's great to see you. There's more of you, even though we're socially distancing. It's awesome to see your faces. And we have people joining us from 16 different states and people that are joining us from South America and Southeast Asia. So it's awesome to have all of these together. It's incredible how we can leverage technology. And so if you're at home and you're nervous about attending, no judgment. We're glad you're home. We're glad you're safe. Thank you for being here for those of you that are live. Let's grab our Bibles. If you brought a Bible with you, we have a Bible for you if you need one. Let's turn to Mark chapter 10. It's taken us 3 weeks to get through Mark chapter 10. I thought we could do it in 2 weeks. Apparently, it took us three because last week felt like God wanted us to linger on a particular story, one of the most confusing and misunderstood stories, I think, in all of the Gospels anyway. And if you missed that, you can go online or on our app and catch up with us because we're in Mark chapter 10. We're going to complete Mark chapter 10. I'll tell you what verse in just a second. Let me talk about crisis for just a little bit because when you think of crisis, is defined this way. A sequence of events that might cause instability or danger in your life that affects the future direction in your life. Crisis is a sequence of events that creates instability or danger that affects the future of your life. And so I had one crisis. We've had many crises in our lives as a couple, as a family, little to big. Would you agree with me that crises come in different shapes and sizes? Church, would you agree with me on that? Right? I mean, it could be simply a pipe that's broken, which is a big deal, actually, probably. Or it could be something in your attic, or I don't know what it is for you, but we all experience crisis. Again, we might all be in a pandemic crisis in our lives. And so because of this, there's a couple responses that we might want to have. In a crisis, it might take you experiencing a turning point. A lot of crises have experienced a turning point. And I know that we are praying that God would intervene with this pandemic that we're experiencing now, as some are sick and some are hurting. But we hope there's a turning point that takes place in crises. And then in a crisis, it usually takes a decisive change, that you and I need to decide something in our lives, to make a change of some kind, typically, either to do something or an attitude or something that might be in your life. And so we think of crisis in this way. What I want to do with you is to look in Mark chapter 10. You're going to see a crisis there, and we're going to learn three things from the disciples, the 12 in particular, about how you and I can take care of and handle crisis in our lives. Three things that I want to look at with you today. So your Bibles are open. Turn with me to Mark chapter 10, and we'll pick it up in verse 32. Let me read it for you, and then we'll talk about this. Mark chapter 10, verse 32. It says this, "And they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them. And they were amazed, and those who followed were afraid." Now, I want you to notice that. They were afraid. If you've been tracking with us in this study of the Overlook Gospel of Mark, you've known that there's lots of tension that's going on here. Jesus is going to tell the disciples a third time that he's going to go into Jerusalem to die and then to walk away from a grave 3 days later. That's why we're experiencing communion today, because on the first weekend of every month, we take communion as a reminder of what took place for us. And as we celebrate the 4th of July and we think about the freedom of our land, church, can I tell you that there's a freedom that's greater than that? And I think we would all agree, a freedom that we can have from our sins, a freedom that we can have from our own selves, in a sense, a freedom that by surrendering our life to Jesus Christ, that we become followers of Jesus, and he gives us freedom, not only from this life, but then from the next life. We have freedom to be able to live eternally with him forever, and it's awesome to think about that. But as we're thinking through Mark chapter 10, there was all kinds of tension. It's one of those situations where you could cut the tension with a knife. You know what I'm talking about? Have you ever been in a situation where it's tense and you can just cut the room with a knife? You can just sort of sense it and feel it. And I want you to get that idea as we read this. In chapter 3, well, we read that the disciples were there and the Pharisees were there, and Jesus was having a conversation with the Pharisees, and they run off to plot his murder. Now, what's interesting to me is that that tension runs all the way through from chapter 3 all the way to chapter 10, because the Pharisees confronted Jesus and Jesus confronted the Pharisees, and the disciples thought that Jesus was going to go into Jerusalem and take over the Romans, that he was going to topple the Romans, that the kingdom of God looked like the Romans being overthrown, and that created a lot of tension as well because they knew how brutal the Romans were. So there was lots of tension going on. There was lots of fear that was going on here, and the disciples were there. Now, we've been studying this book, Mark, and we've learned this, that the only role that Jesus will play in our lives is to be God. That when you think of Jesus, if you're a guest with us here or you're online with us for the very first time, we need you to know, as a church family, we need you to know that really we believe that the only hope that you can find in life is through Jesus Christ. Right, church? That's the only hope we can find. And so we would want you to understand who Jesus is and what he did for you, because the only role that Jesus will play in our lives is for him to be God. And here, as the disciples were facing this journey into Jerusalem, they're almost there. In fact, at the end of chapter 10, they arrive in Jerusalem. And as they go in, there's all kinds of tension. And we learn our first truth about crisis. You may want to jot this down. This is really important. Three things that will help us in dealing with crisis. Now, there may be more, but we learn in this passage anyway, there's at least three that you and I need in our life. And the first is this, that when we face crisis, we need a godly response to fear. Would you agree with me, church, that when the crisis comes into your life, whether it's something in your attic or something else, that fear can slip into your life? Am I right? That when you experience a crisis, one of the things that may take place in your life is fear. In fact, I think one of the things that we're dealing with in our culture today is a lot of fear. And it's rightly so, and yet it's fear that is creating all kinds of emotion for people and all kinds of attitudes for people, and it's difficult to manage. But you know, if you're a follower of Jesus, What we learn in this passage here of these disciples is that when we face a crisis, we need a godly response to fear. When you and I experience fear in our life, they tell us anyway, that you usually will have one of two reactions. See if you know it. That either you will fight or you will have flight, right? Those are typically the two responses that we have, according to the experts, that when you experience fear in your life, you're going to either fight or flight. And what I want to do today is I want to suggest something different for you. I want to suggest a third choice that I think we have as followers of Jesus. But let's read on. Verse 33. The disciples were afraid, the people that were there are afraid, and they're on their way into Jerusalem. And it says in verse 33, see, we are going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus says this, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles or the Romans. Now, if you like theology at any level, I really encourage you to circle two words in what we just read. Two important words that will help us in theology or understanding God. And that is the word delivered and deliver. Jesus says, I will be delivered over to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn me to death and deliver me. This is really important that we get this. The Jews didn't kill Jesus. The Romans didn't kill Jesus, even though it may have been at their hands. I want you to know it's really important theologically that we understand that God delivered his one and only son to die. It wasn't because the Romans were mad. It wasn't because the Pharisees and the Jews were mad. It was because God actually delivered him to them. As a matter of fact, that's why you often will read in the Gospels where Jesus does a miracle and he says, don't tell anybody. And the reason he says that is because he doesn't want the tension to build too soon because God delivers Jesus to the hands of the Pharisees and scribes. Did you get that, church? That's really important theology to know that nobody killed Jesus. God allowed Jesus to be crucified for your life and for mine and then to walk away. Let's read it. Verse 34, and they will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him, and after 3 days he will rise. You know, when I look at that list, I've seen maybe two of those in my life. Look at that list. Mock him, spit on him, flog him, kill him. I've been mocked, maybe you have. I've been in certain places of the world where I was spit on. For a variety of different reasons. I've never been flogged, and obviously never been killed. But you look at this list, it's an amazing list, and then it says, after 3 days, he will arise. See, when fear comes into our life, we will either fight or there will be flight. Talk about fight for just a little bit. When we fight, when we're ready to go, maybe you're in the attic and there's a raccoon or whatever it might be, and you're ready to fight, what happens is fighting in our lives, due to fear in our lives, causes us to experience terrible judgment. Have you noticed that? That when you're in a crisis and you stand to fight, typically what happens because of fear in your life, there's going to be terrible judgment that takes place in your life. Or you be closed-minded according to Proverbs chapter 18. When fear comes in and grips you and you want to fight, it causes you to be very closed-minded. On the other hand, you might flight or you might run away or you might get away or you might try to find a way to get away. And sometimes there is no way to get away. There's a third option though. Let me give it to you. You can fight or flight, or, get this, force. A force inside of you can cause you to be able to deal with crisis in a very different way. Let me show you. Because Paul, in talking to a young man, Timothy, in 2 Timothy chapter 1, said this, for this reason, for the reason of faith, again, if you've surrendered your life to God and you've accepted what Jesus did for you, you have faith in Jesus. You are a follower of Jesus. And we'd invite you to do that today if that's not where you are. We would love for you to find hope that way. And so Paul's talking to Timothy and says, for this reason, because of your faith, I remind you to fan into flame. In other words, make this white hot in your life. Because if you don't get this, when crisis comes in, you know what happens? You will gravitate towards fear, and there'll either be fight or flight in your life. And so he says, fan this into flame, the gift of God, for God gave us a spirit not of fear, but of power, love, and self-control. Church, you probably have heard this verse before. This is so important that I want you to say it out loud wherever you're at, or you can write it in the chat section if you want, or if you're in your living room, just say it out loud to the people. If you're on the beach, say it out loud. I don't know, somebody will think you're at church or something on the beach. But say it out loud with me. These three words, power, love, and self-control. Here we go, church. We're going to say it together. Number one, power, love, self-control. You see, you need power in order to love. The power that comes from within. I'm not talking about physical power or strength to get through it. We had some friends over on Friday night, and these friends have two little kids, and we did the social distancing enough to, you know, we were fine. And so they had two little kids. One of them was a daughter who's 4 years of age, and one of them's a son who's a couple years older than her. So we were out in the yard, you know, just getting outside because the kids were young and they had some energy and so forth. And we were talking, then dinner was ready. And so I said to her, the little four-year-old girl, I said, it's time for dinner. Let's go inside. And she says, okay. And so we were walking together and she grabs my hand. And then she says to me, because we'd walked away from her little brother who was with his dad, and she says, my brother thinks he's a lion. And he has a very loud roar. But I want you to know, and she's looking up at me, and I'm looking down at her, holding her hand. I got these big hands, and she's this little tiny little, you know. She says, but I want you to know that I'm a Pokemon, and I am much stronger than he is. I just thought I would tell you that. I don't know if you got little kids or you. Pokemon apparently is stronger than a lion. I didn't know that. I don't know if you knew that or not. I mean, so I said, oh, wow, I didn't know that. And we went in the house. See, this is not the kind of power I'm talking about. I'm talking about the fact that the Bible tells us that when you are a follower of Jesus, what's given to you is the Spirit of God that's deposited inside of you. That there's a power within inside of you. The same power, by the way, if you want to underline, that allowed Jesus to walk away 3 days later from the grave, that's available to you and I as we face crisis, that we can have an internal strength that the world doesn't have. Power inside of us that will help us to understand love. Do you realize that without that internal power, it is really hard to love those who don't love us? And when you understand the power that goes into the love of in our lives, and that love is important in order to have self-control, and you can't have self-control without power, and it comes all the way back around. Power, love, self-control. Don't miss this, church. These three things are so important to our understanding that when you face crisis, see, we need a godly response to fear. And he gives it to us in the Spirit in order that we might have power and love and self-control. There's a second thing that we'll read on in the story here. Let's pick it up. The second thing is this, that when we face crisis, it requires humility that only God can produce. Now, I'm sure you've heard talks or messages on humility, and even in your own minds, sometimes it's hard to define humility. Like, what is really humility? I want to look at that with you for just a second. But humility is something that you can't manufacture in your life. You can't wake up in the morning and say, you know, I think I'm going to just be more humble today. I mean, even by saying that, it kind of goes against the word, right? It's not something that you can work really hard at and be a humble person. It is produced in you by God. Now, what's interesting about this idea of humility is that when we talk about crisis, it's counterintuitive, really. I mean, how is it that when we face crisis that humility comes into the conversation? Well, let me tell you why. This is really important. Because crisis has the potential of creating a me-centric life. Have you recognized that? That when you're hit with crisis, if you're not careful, what happens is the whole world shuts off and all you see and hear is yourself. And what ends up happening is there's dark thinking that goes on in your life. Mistrust, negativity. Would you agree with me that there's all kinds of negativity right now? Negativity is everywhere around us. There's a sense of doubt. There's a sense of self-promotion. When you have a me-centric life because you shut the world off because you're experiencing crisis and fear sets in, and so we're asking God to help us with that. But humility is important because without humility, you're going to have a me-centric life and you'll be self-promoting in your life. You will always worry. Worry will consume you. So let me ask you the question. What worry is consuming you right now? Because worry is evidenced of a me-centric life. Jesus, when he was there, I want you to see that it takes place actually with the disciples. Pick it up in verse 35. So Jesus talks to them and says, I'm going to die. We're going to Jerusalem, but I'm going to walk away from the grave 3 days later. James and John obviously didn't get it. Here's what happens. And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, so we have James Zebedee and John Zebedee, came up to him and said, Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask you. And he said to them, What do you want me to do for you? And they said, Grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory. Remember that phrase. We'll come back to it. In your glory. You do not even know what you're asking, Jesus responded to them. Now, if you want to, you can read the same story in Matthew chapter 20. And some might say when you read Matthew chapter 20 that the Bible contradicts itself. It actually doesn't. Because in Matthew chapter 20, Matthew tells us that James and John's mother, so Mom Zebedee, asked Jesus the question. How many of you know that when mom asks, it's just as good as like you asking, right? And so here it is, they ask the question, can we sit to your left and can we sit to your right? The disciples, James and John in particular, didn't get it. Again, they thought that Jesus was going into Jerusalem, going to turn over Rome, and Jesus was going to be in charge, and there's going to be a kingdom, and James and John wanted a position of authority and power, and so can we sit at the right and the left hand? And so Jesus says, are you able to drink the cup that I drink or be able to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized? And the two of them said, we are. That ought to tell you right there, they were clueless. We are. And Jesus said to them, the cup that I drink, you will drink. And with the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand or at my left, it's not up to me to grant. But it is for those for whom it has been prepared. You know who's sitting at the right hand of the Father? Jesus. He's speaking about himself here. It's really interesting. Jesus talks about this cup, and he says, if you're a follower of mine, you're going to experience the cup. And he says, if you're a follower of mine, you're going to experience a baptism. Let me make sure that we understand these two things. The cup is reference to suffering. Do you realize that if you've surrendered your life to Jesus and you're a follower of Jesus, that Jesus tells us that we're going to experience some suffering? I don't like it. I don't think you like it. But he says, we're going to experience some suffering in life. There's going to be times where you will be misunderstood as a follower of Jesus. The baptism, on the other hand, is speaking of the Spirit, that something's going to take place inside of us. We already talked about the power and love and self-control. That something can take place on the inside of us that God has prepared for us. And what he's talking about there is the same thing that Paul was talking about in Philippians chapter 2. In referencing Jesus, this is what Paul says in Philippians 2. And being found in human form, Jesus, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Paul says that death is not even enough, it's death on a cross. It's a brutal, brutal, suffocating, torturous death on a cross. Church, do you realize that Jesus' glory was its highest? Don't miss this. Remember the phrase, for his glory? Jesus' glory was at its highest found through humility. Humility. And the reason why humility is so important is because it's possible for us to have a me-centric life. Well, the other 10 heard about it. Look at verse 41. Then when the 10 heard it, they began to be indignant at James and John. Wouldn't you? I mean, who are James and John? They get the positions of, like, you know, And so their disciples, I can just imagine reading between the lines that there's a conversation going on between these 12 disciples that they're not happy at all. See, the reason why humility is required when we experience crisis is because of the potential of a me-centric life. Here's the second thing I'll tell you about humility, and that's this. The reason why humility is important is because of the fact that crisis affects our hearts. When you have a crisis in your life, it affects our hearts. That's why Solomon, talking to his son, said this. Proverbs chapter 4 says, "Keep your heart with all vigilance." The word keep here is the word guard. In fact, in the original language, the imagery is if you were standing there and you had four guards on either side of you, guarding you at all times. Guard your heart with all vigilance. So you don't guard something unless it's valuable. Am I right? So your heart is very valuable. Your heart is what, you know, flows. And so guard your heart with all vigilance, for from it flows the springs of life. And so if we're not careful when crisis hits, our heart is attacked and it impacts us in our relationships, in our attitudes, and the things that take place. So it requires humility that can come only from God. You know what humility is? Let me give you my shot at what humility is. I think humility is the willingness to first listen. James talks about that, the brother of Jesus. Humility is the willingness to understand before being understood. Humility is the willingness to care above yourself beyond a me-centric life. Humility is the willingness to love those who love you, those who disagree with you, those who persecute you, those who hate you, those who are enemies of yours. Humility allows us to disagree and yet love. That's why humility is so important. Verse 42, and Jesus called them to him, that's the disciples, and he said to them, now all 12, now he's not just talking to John and James, he's talking to all 12. He said, you know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles, or the Romans, lord it over them, and with great ones exercise authority over them. So he says, you guys need to know this, that the Romans have these people in high positions and they lord it over them, meaning they make people's lives miserable. And they also have people that are in positions of authority and they make lives even more miserable. And I love this next phrase, underline this in your Bibles. But it shall not be so. Jesus says, it shall not be so. Five words. Remember these five words. It shall not be so. It shall not be so. It shall not be so. You got it, church? It shall not be so. We're different. We're different. To the world around us, we're different. And he says, it shall not be so among you, but whoever will be great among you must be your servant, and whoever must be first among you must be your slave of all. And even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. Let me say it this way. Humility is moving from the problem to the people in the problem. See, when crisis strikes, humility will cause us to move from the problem to the people in the problem. And that's what makes us different. That's why this is so important for us during this crisis that we all are experiencing, or individual crisis that we might have with animals in our attics or relationships or things at work or whatever it might be, that in the midst of this crisis, we need God to help us with anger. And it requires humility that only God can produce inside of us. And thirdly and lastly, this is what we learn, that in crisis, it reveals that we are beggars before Jesus. That we're beggars. That in crisis, we need someone to rescue us. We need somebody to be our savior. We need somebody that we can go to and listen to a question that Jesus would ask. Let's look at it. In verse 46, as they came to Jericho, so the disciples and all these people that were following, Jericho is the last city before you get to Jerusalem. If you know anything about geography, Jericho is just right here, and you got to go uphill to Jerusalem. It's the last city before you get to Jerusalem. And so They came to Jericho, and as they were leaving Jericho with his disciples and a great crowd, Bartimaeus, a blind beggar, the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside. And when he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." Verse 48 is troubling. And many rebuked him, telling him to be silent. Quiet. You're not that important. I mean, we got an entourage going here. We're on our way to Jerusalem. A couple of us might sit on the left and right. Who knows? Quiet. But he cried out even more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." And Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." And I want to inject almost a sarcastic comment here, because, and they called the blind man, saying to him, I can imagine them just going over to him and saying, "All right, take heart, get up, he's calling you." And so he threw off his cloak and he sprang up and came to Jesus, and Jesus said to him, and this question is brilliant. Listen to this question today as if Jesus is asking you specifically, "What do you want me to do for you?" Wow. What do you want me to do for you? Church, I don't know about you, but when we face crisis, we come as beggars. We come like blind men and women, hoping that spiritual sight will be given to us. That in an area of our life, if Jesus were to ask you today, "What can I do for you?" How would you answer that? Bartimaeus said, "Rabbi, let me recover my sight." And Jesus said, "Go away. Your faith has made you well." And immediately he recovered his sight and followed him on the way. And chapter 10 ends. They get to Jerusalem. Chances are those disciples learned some lessons about crisis. Peter was in that crowd. And Peter later wrote this in 2 Peter chapter 1. He said, "His divine power has granted to us all things that pertain to life." All things that pertain to life. "And godliness through the knowledge of him who called us to his own glory and excellence." Peter heard Jesus talking about this and repeats it. And he talks about this power that's been given to us, that when you face a crisis, when you and I face a crisis, it needs godly wisdom in handling fear. It requires humility that only God can bring into our lives. And we come as beggars, hearing a question, "What do you want me to do for you?" So we end this way. See, if Jesus is God of our lives, let's ask him for spiritual sight and humility.